It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the latest invasive insect in the United States is the Asian giant hornet. We'll talk with a bug expert about why it's a danger to honeybees and potentially humans and what scientists on the West Coast are doing to try to contain it. First, it's the first Monday of the month, which means it's time for another edition of Mondays with Mike. WPR director Mike Crane stops by each month, either on Central Time, The Morning Show, or The Larry Miller Show, to talk about what's happening both on and off the air. This time, we're going to talk about how COVID-19 is affecting our work here at WPR, give some upcoming special programming information, Giving Tuesday is coming up, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about why we do what we do and the way we do it? Any programming feedback? Is there a show or type of show you want to hear more or less of? Maybe you got a question about our website, WPR.org. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here, Rob.
Let's start with Giving Tuesday. Now, that's something I think of happening usually later in the year. What's up with this May Giving Tuesday?
It is a different Giving Tuesday. It was just recently invented, and they were calling it internationally Giving Tuesday Now. And the idea is for people throughout the world to unite in supporting nonprofits, the organizations that do all kinds of crucial work in their communities. And we certainly are on the list of nonprofits who need financial support to do all the amazing work that you and your colleagues do, Rob. And so it feels like a natural for us to celebrate all of the nonprofits and to invite people to support WPR as one of their choices.
So what are people going to hear here on the air tomorrow?
Well, it'll be, you know, sort of like a member drive, but very brief a couple of messages over the course of an hour. So not the typical member drive. We actually finished a kind of a different member drive a few weeks ago, also because of how coronavirus has changed the world. And so this is just one of the many opportunities we take over the course of a year to seek people's support.
And that leads to our next topic, Mike. This whole situation has affected fundraising for many organizations, including Wisconsin Public Radio. For example, that fundraising drive, the member drive you just mentioned, we did it a little differently than usual. Can you talk about how WPR is being affected here?
Well, you know, we have just tremendous support all the time from our listeners. And so we've been gratified to see most sustainers staying on with us and actually money being raised during that member drive. And I'm sure tomorrow people will support as well. But one place that we've really been hit hard is in our business support. Any radio or television station or newspaper will tell you that a lot of businesses are, as you know, suffering. And one of the things that tends to go in that case is things like a business's philanthropic support for public radio. And so we're seeing that that's probably going to be tight for a very long time without knowing when things turn around. And as our communities wrestle with opening back up, as they call it.
So between that member drive, the sort of low-key member drive we just had, and Giving Tuesday, what kind of ways can people support WPR during this time, Mike?
Certainly, literally making the pledge or the contribution online at WPR.org. And we also have the phone number that they can call. It's 800-383-9772. And people will hear about that. We've also, this has been very nice to see, people are considering other ways they can support, such as making a contribution from their IRA minimum distribution as a charitable rollover gift, and people are giving gifts of stock, and that does continue. I know we're in a time that people feel is especially uncertain, but people are being generous, and part of the hope for Giving Tuesday is that they will do so for all of the nonprofits that they care about, if they're able. Some people are in situations where we know they can't right now, and that makes sense to take care first of themselves.
Can you talk more generally, Mike, about how the COVID-19 situation has affected our operations here at WPR and how it's going to affect them in the months to come?
Yeah, you know, like any business that really needs to stay operating, and we know that broadcasters and now, of course, online as well, we're just such a vital source for information. People tell us that all the time. And so from the very start, when we were, as they sometimes say, bugging out of the building, we were concentrated on two things. One was the safety of our staff, because we want them to be able to continue to provide this service. And the other was preserving service. And I think we've done very well with that. It has required tremendous ingenuity, patience, inventiveness on the part of so many of our staff, most especially probably our on-air and our engineering crews, but really also the development folks raising money, all kinds of effort, just as is happening in other businesses. So in that sense, I don't feel like we're special, but we are part of the story. And, you know, one of the things that maybe isn't remarkable anymore, Rob, is that I'm talking to you on the phone, just as many of your guests do. But what is remarkable is that we're a far more distributed staff than we're used to. Many people are not working in the office at the moment. And yet we're all getting used to the Skype meetings, Zoom meetings, GoTo meeting, WebEx. What have I missed?
All those different ways of the above.
And Microsoft Teams, and we're really, you know, it's 2 months since we exited the pre-COVID past, and people are getting used to doing new things. And, you know, I find myself wondering, I can be pretty philosophical at times, whether essentially we're being yanked into a future that many people imagine, specifically in the terms of how we work. It's fascinating and as well as daunting, obviously.
It's Mondays with Mike. We're talking to WPR Director Mike Crane. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kay starts us off in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I am wondering what's happening to 1A. It seems like in the last month or so there's been several different hosts, and I'm wondering what progress they're making on finding a new permanent host.
Oh, thanks for the question, Kay. You know, I think they really thought they were close, and then COVID. I think that's part of it, is that I think some people are making very different decisions about their work and their life than they might have made even a few months ago. And so what they're continuing to do is they have Sasha Ann Simmons as a regular sub. She's going to be Mondays and Tuesdays now, and they're bringing back a favorite of many people in public radio. Celeste Headlee is going to be hosting Wednesdays through Fridays. And I'm familiar with Celeste, know her a little bit. She's just a great radio host as well. And they'll continue to use substitutes until they identify a new permanent host. And I know what happened, for those that don't know, is Joshua Johnson, the first host of 1A, got a job at NBC that he was very excited to move on to. And so it was a shame because he was also a really compelling host. But Celeste and Sasha Ann are doing a great job, I'm sure.
Okay, thanks a lot for the question. We'll go to Steve now with us in Shawano. Steve, hello.
Hello. I understand that a sulfide mine is going in at the headwaters of the Wolf River, about 60 miles upriver from Shawano. Is WPR going to ask each of the candidates in tonight's debate where they are on that? And then I would like to know when WPR is going to do a big story on how sulfide mining always ruins the water. Thank you.
So thanks, Steve, for the question. There is a debate that's going to be broadcasting. Rob, you know this, the broadcasting on several of our stations. Mm-hmm. It's specifically for the 7th Congressional District. And so that's why we're broadcasting it on the stations that are connected in any way to the 7th District. But we also will have it, you can listen to it on WPR.org, and we'll also be rebroadcasting it. And certainly, Steve, I know you and others have reached out to WPR to express their concerns about the sulfide mine story and also some other stories of concern in that area. And, you know, I could never say we'll have a story by X time or date, but rest assured that mining in the North Country has been an abiding interest of ours and something we'll definitely be giving coverage to. And so I'd say listen for it, look for it on WPR.org as time continues, and tune in if you're in that area, tune in live on the radio or listen and read later at WPR.org.
Thanks a lot for that call. Again, 7 p.m. tonight is that debate. You can hear it on the air out of our stations in Superior, Wausau, and Eau Claire, or as Mike mentioned, online at WPR.org. And we'll be hearing from both of those candidates, by the way, this Thursday and Friday at 3:30. Republican Tom Tiffany on Thursday, Democrat Tricia Zunker on Friday. It is Monday with Mike. We're talking to WPR Director Mike Crane about the latest goings-on here at WPR and answering your questions as well at 800-642-1234. If you have a question or a comment, praise, or critique for WPR to share with us, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane for the May edition of Mondays with Mike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your question or comment about Wisconsin Public Radio? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike, before we get back to our callers, often on Mondays with Mike, we talk about upcoming events and WPR travel opportunities. Well, right now we can talk about ones that are not going to happen, sadly. Can you tell us what's off the table for now?
Yeah, unfortunately, we were so excited to be getting ready for the Simply Folk Shindig. It was scheduled for next month in the Wausau area. It looks like we'll be rescheduling with the headline performer Becky Buller for June of next year. And let's hope that everything's well cleared up by then, because the shindigs are just a wonderful, fun concert, dance, everything that happens around folk music. And then also we had some fundraising travel that was scheduled for people that have gone all over the world with us at various times. And we're postponing all of those a year again because of COVID. In the works, but without anything to share yet, are some virtual events. Because we do love connecting with our listeners in various different ways. And so as soon as we've got that figured out, there will be announcements online and in our newsletters and on the air, of course, as well.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hey, Mike. I thought I was the only one with the name Mike.
Yes, very few in my generation were named Mike, that's for sure.
I love the show, The People's Pharmacy. It's so pertinent with this virus the way it is. I only wish that it was on in better hours in the mornings, and I only wish that they would repeat it. It's an excellent, it's the best medical show you got.
Thanks for the comment.
Mike.
One thing that I know is true for me, I would personally agree with that. It's kind of on a little early on Saturday for me, but it is actually a great radio listening time. Radio prime time is considered to be the morning. And so that's part of why we have a really strong show there. And as some people know, we did used to repeat it Saturday afternoons, but we looked at it and it wasn't winning a lot of listeners there. So I guess what that means is that a vast majority of people were finding it in the morning. And so we thought we'd try something else. But that's the basic idea. I'm so glad, Mike, also named Mike, that you value People's Pharmacy.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. Before I go back to some more callers, Mike Crane, we shared some unfortunate news about travel and event cancellations. Let's share some good news now, Mike. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association inducted two of our big figures at Wisconsin Public Media into the Hall of Fame. Who were they?
Yeah, well, officially they'll have to do it next year, according to their announcement. But they did announce that my predecessor, Jack Mitchell, he was the WPR director from 1976 to 1997. He created our regional bureaus and the Ideas Network, working with the great team. And Jack was also NPR's first employee as a producer and newscaster for All Things Considered back in the early 70s. And the other one, Jack is still with us, but unfortunately the other honoree is not. Nancy Zeman hosted the longest running sewing series on television, Sewing with Nancy, truly beloved by people all over the country and the world. And it was produced here at PBS Wisconsin, and it was broadcast on 223 public TV stations in all 50 states. And I know that in addition to this honor, remembering Nancy, that our colleagues down the right now virtual hall are planning on some special ways to honor Nancy's legacy with special broadcasts and so on. So watch for that when the time comes.
So big news for the past of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Media there. And now recent awards for WPR content from the current day from organizations like the WBA, the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association, and others. Give us a couple of the highlights, Mike, before we bring on some more callers.
Sure. Two of our special project series were recognized by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists and the Milwaukee Press Club. Derailed, that wonderful, what I've come to call podcast forward, meaning we started with a podcast but had all kinds of other coverage called Derailed. That was our series about the train that never was in Wisconsin. And High Tolerance, which is our truly groundbreaking and excellent series on our complicated relationship with alcohol here in our state. Also, our digital team was recognized for its work in social media and special project digital design, podcast, online news coverage. WPR News earned a whole bunch of awards. We'll put it all online because it's quite a list. And just very proud of everyone for the good work they do on behalf of the citizens of the state on WPR.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 on this edition of Mondays with Mike, Director Mike Crane, head of Wisconsin Public Radio with me. Bill joins us now in Chippewa Falls. Bill, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'd like to thank you both for everything you do for our entire state. I listen to you at least 12 hours a day, and I learn an awful lot. My question is, I used to love to listen to the Click and Clack show Saturday mornings. I understand why it was stopped. Is it possible that you possibly might start a show on the weekends about NASCAR, which is a widely covered and enjoyed sport by many, many people?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't typically found a ton of interest in NASCAR that doesn't include actually seeing the cars going round and round, but it's something we could talk about. It's certainly, as you say, Bill, it's a big part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And I know they were among the first sports to consider ways that they could continue to function during the era of COVID. So that in itself may be of interest. And boy, I agree with you. I miss Click and Clack. They were quite a pair. No way to reproduce them for sure. Well, we'll pass this. Yeah.
Thanks a lot
we'll
for that call.
And we do our content people. Yeah.
We do talk about sports from time to time. We can get some NASCAR into the mix. And by the way, a note, Larry Mueller does a vehicle maintenance show every other month. I don't think Larry probably yucks it up quite as much as Click and Clack did, but you can at least get a little taste of some auto maintenance there. Back to your calls now. Mike joins us in La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hi, my phone beeped. I hope this is me.
It's you. You're
it is
on.
You.
All right, one more mic. So my question or comment is about the shows being repeated throughout the day. I understand that you repeat them because people miss them at other times, but when the host, say Rob Ferret, says, call in now, and gives the phone number to call, if it's pre-recorded, then you can't really call in. And I was wondering if maybe somebody could, you know, alter the recording of the show so that when the phone number is given instead, maybe Rob's voice comes on and says, this has been pre-recorded, thanks for listening, but you can't call in now.
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike Crane.
Yeah, it's an interesting suggestion. We've talked about it, but the complexity would be having to make a significant number of internal edits to the show. And part of why we repeat things is because we already are running out of time to do everything we're trying to do. We do run an announcement at the head of shows periodically indicating that that's a repeat segment. One thing that some people don't know, Mike, and everybody, is actually that even shows like Zorba Pastor on Your Health, they're actually recorded. We're live right now, but of course, when this repeats later, we won't be. And that's always a puzzle. But I think if we had the resources to do it, and this would be a lot more resources, we'd love to be live all the time. And that just isn't feasible.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just a couple of minutes left, Mike. I wanted to mention some learning opportunities from PBS Wisconsin. Again, our neighbors down the virtual hallway there. Can you give us a sense of some of the things they're doing to help kids learn at home?
Yeah, they've been all over it, so to speak. PBS Wisconsin and Milwaukee PBS, working with the Department of Public Instruction, have a new TV broadcast schedule to support at-home learning. And so that's all day long. It's a pre-K to 12 schedule, 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's on the Wisconsin Channel, which is also known as PBS Wisconsin 2, and also streaming online at pbswisconsin.org/family-resources. It's got all kinds of things that are covered, English language arts, social studies, science and math. There's also PBS Kids, which has been there all along for pre-K through third grade, and that's on our main channel and also on our 24/7 kids channel. And that's on television, on demand, and also streaming. They're also doing something really interesting called Bright by Text. It provides a text message tips for parents and caregivers of children under 8 to help support their learning and development as kids. And so you'll hear our announcements periodically inviting people to text in and then get that Bright by Text information.
Mike, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Goes so fast, Rob. Great to talk to you.
You too. That's Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. He comes on the Ideas Network once a month, either on Central Time, The Morning Show, or The Larry Miller Show to talk about WPR programming and operations. He'll be on next June 1st with Larry Miller. Coming up after the news, we'll find out about an invasive insect being called the murder hornet that's made its way to the western United States for the first time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Washington Post columnist makes the case for Senator Tammy Baldwin as former Vice President Joe Biden's running mate. First, a new invasive species has made its way to the western United States. The Asian giant hornet was identified in Washington state late last year. You might have seen them referred to as murder hornets. While they aren't thought to be anywhere near Wisconsin at this point, the damage these hornets can do is causing concern. Its sting can be dangerous for humans, but it's an even bigger hazard for honeybees. And with spring weather bringing the hornets out of hibernation, scientists are working with citizens to identify and hopefully get rid of them. Todd Murray is an entomologist and invasive species expert with Washington State University Extension, where he's the director of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Program Unit. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
These sound scary. The online things I've been seeing sound pretty scary. Can you give us kind of the 101 on these invasive hornets? So what do they look like? What do they act like?
Well, they're very large, hence the name, and that's likely why they attract so much attention. They're a very large hornet, and in fact, they're one of the largest hornets on the planet.
And where do they come from? Where is their natural habitat before they're showing up here in the U.S.?
Their native range is along the Pacific Rim, and they also occur in Japan. So they're native to that Southeast Asia part of the world.
Talk about what you've seen out there in Washington State so far.
Well, again, we've only had a few reports, and we've had some activity just over the border in British Columbia with our Canadian counterparts, where they've found and eradicated a nest late last fall. Then we had a couple specimens, or at least one specimen, show up in Blaine, Washington, which is just over the Canadian border here in Washington State. So it's only been found in a couple locations, and we hope that that's all it's delegated to and hasn't expanded out from there.
So only a few sightings. One of the reasons I understand people are concerned is what this could mean for honeybees here in the United States, already facing problems of their own. Why are these hornets a potential threat to honeybees in the U.S.?
Well, they are designed and adapted to feeding on honeybee-type insects, so other insects that form these larger social nests. And what they do is they go through a very distinctive staged attack, where the first phase is called a hunting phase, where individual hornet will find the bee in the hive and make a little meatball out of it and bring that back to its own nest to communicate to its other fellows in the hornet nest. Then they'll stage a slaughter phase where they go in and attack and kill all the adult bees of that hive, and then they go into an occupation phase where then they actually occupy the honeybee nest for a few days and collect and feed on the pupae and the larvae of the honeybees, because that's what they're actually there to feed on.
And when it comes to humans, I understand the people who've been stung by these hornets really remember it. Painful and potentially dangerous. Can you talk about how they affect us humans?
Well, it's really the size that causes the concern. The larger the hornet, the more venom it's capable of injecting into you. So it's more of a dose issue than a toxicity issue. Their venom is similar to other venoms out there, like in a yellow jacket or a bee that people are used to. So people can react to that venom in different ways. But it's really about the dose that this insect is able to deliver. And if someone happened upon a ground nest and disturbed them and had a few angry hornets come out and sting them, that would be a significant amount of venom injected into that person. So I think that's where most of the health concern is, where this insect occurs naturally.
We're talking to Todd Murray, entomologist and invasive species expert with Washington State's University Extension. We're talking about this large invasive Asian giant hornet. People have been calling it the murder hornet. A few spotted in the northwestern part of the United States and across the border in Canada. Efforts now to contain them. Todd, I understand you've spent some time here in Wisconsin, and I'll tell you, we're really pulling for you to contain these things before they spread any further. What is going on out there in efforts to spot these guys and stop them from spreading?
Well, just like you mentioned in the opening, is we're educating Washingtonians on how to recognize and report suspect hornets. Our Washington State Department of Agriculture is leading that eradication effort. Our Washington State Invasive Species Council has developed a cell phone app, which we're encouraging people to download so they can report a sighting. But it's really important for those Washingtonians out there listening is to run away if you see one and then report it later. So make sure you're in a safe distance before you report it.
And you don't want people to take the law into their own hands, I understand, and try to eradicate these by themselves?
No, it's best to let the experts do it. The experts actually had to purchase specialized suits to protect them from the stings. The stingers are so long that a regular honeybee suit doesn't protect you adequately enough.
Wow.
So they've actually had to purchase special hornet suits.
Now, what kind of habitat do these Asian giant hornets seem to prefer?
That's a great question. And when a new species finds a new home in a place that they don't normally occur in, there's going to be some local adaptation, and that's what we'll learn over time if this species establishes. But it prefers forested habitats or the edge of forests, and they nest underground, which is adding a little bit more challenge for us to identify and detect those nests for eradication. But again, you know, as with all invasive species, when they're brand new to our continent or brand new to a territory, we need to research them a little bit to understand what their full capabilities are in their new habitat. In this case, we feel pretty confident that this one won't establish, and we have a good shot at eradicating it because it was reported so early.
Here in Wisconsin, as I'm guessing you know, we have our share of invasive species from the purple loosestrife and the zebra mussels and emerald ash borers. How much of a difference does it make if you can detect something like this early and take action early in preventing it from spreading?
You know, it is so comparable to all the ills of our life. The earlier you can detect something wrong, the faster and easier it is and more cost-effective it is to take care of the problem. So again, this one, we only have a few reports, and we think that it's just a localized location that we can identify those nests in and actually get a chance to eradicate it. If we let this go on for a few more years or 5 years, it would be much more difficult, much more expensive for us to get a handle on that problem as it expands and adapts to our local environment. So it's really important that people report something. If it's something new to them, contact their local extension office, contact their local Department of Agriculture, and report anything suspicious. As the saying goes, if you see something, say something, because that early detection is very important.
As we wrap up, Todd, this one, this particular hornet's gotten a lot of attention in the media, and I think especially social media, just because, you know, the pictures of these things are pretty dramatic, the whole stinging through a beekeeper suit. That sounds pretty scary. In the scope of invasive species that you're dealing with in the state, how much do you worry about this one compared to other things already on your plate?
This one, again, I feel very positive that we're able to get a handle on it early and keep it from establishing in our state. So this one right now, I'm not too worried about. It's our other species that have established that we're having to learn how to live with and manage them. And as you know, we've seen, once a new species establishes, it's a forever change, and there's no going back and resetting the clock. And this is definitely one insect that I don't want to learn to live with. So we're hoping to eradicate it.
I'm with you there, Todd. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Todd Murray, entomologist and invasive species expert with Washington State University Extension. He joined us to talk about the arrival of the Asian giant hornet in the western U.S., a small number detected so far, and the work being done there to contain and eliminate it. Coming up, should Senator Tammy Baldwin leave Wisconsin for a run for the White House on Joe Biden's ticket as vice president? Our next guest says there's a strong case. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, documents unsealed by a federal judge last week are shedding light on the origins of the criminal probe into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. We'll look at what they say about the FBI's approach to the investigation of Flynn's contacts with Russia's ambassador and what may happen next. First, Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin endorsed Joe Biden for president last month.
I'm supporting Joe Biden for president, not just because he's always fought for the bold progressive change that working families in Wisconsin need, but because he understands that everyone deserves to be treated with dignity and respect and afforded the opportunity to thrive.
Our next guest thinks Biden should seriously consider bringing Senator Baldwin onto his ticket as his pick for vice president. Data analyst and political columnist for The Washington Post, David Beiler, has written a series of pieces making the case for different VP candidates. Amy Klobuchar is the most logical, Elizabeth Warren most needed, Tammy Duckworth is the safest and smartest pick. So where does Senator Tammy Baldwin fit in? David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've written, as we said, a bunch of different pieces looking at different candidates. You write that if Biden is serious about winning the presidency, Senator Tammy Baldwin deserves strong consideration. So why would she be the serious pick?
Right. So the line of logic is relatively straightforward, and it works kind of like a process of elimination. So we are fairly certain that one of sort of four or five swing states is going to be the most important one for actually getting Biden or Trump over 270 electoral votes. Biden wants someone who's experienced, probably a senator or a governor. He wants someone who is probably from those one of those states that can help him out. And he's already said that he wants a woman to be his vice presidential nominee. So if you sort of go down the list in Florida, governors and senators are Republicans. In Pennsylvania, the governor and the Democratic senator are both men. In Michigan, you have Gretchen Whitmer, who is one plausible candidate, but she's sort of in the midst of a whole crisis of her own with coronavirus that makes the pick risky. The Democratic senator from Michigan, Gary Peters, is a man. And you sort of go through this list, and what you come up with is that you have Tammy Baldwin as sort of the person that checks all the right boxes. She's someone who could help Biden in Wisconsin, one of the key swing states. And she's, you know, a woman who would be groundbreaking because she's also an LGBT person. And she would potentially satisfy some on the progressive base. So there's really a lot of different advantages to having her as the running mate. And the electoral case, I think, is one of the big ones.
And you looked at how people who'd won statewide office, which is pretty much all the names you ticked off, and some of the others you've written about, how they perform compared to, say, other statewide candidates in their parties. How do you see Senator Baldwin stacking up here in Wisconsin compared to some other alternatives?
Yeah, well, Baldwin's 2018 win margin was pretty significant. It was, if you sort of do a little bit of math and you say, okay, how well should this person have performed versus generic Democrat, Baldwin does well. And this is what I think puts her ahead of Debbie Stabenow, a senator I forgot to mention from Michigan, who performed not as well in the 2018 election, but Baldwin performs well. She's someone who doesn't have any, you know, very immediate, obvious baggage that would disqualify her. She's very obviously qualified. So just in terms of, you know, who's from a swing state, who meets Biden's sort of pre-specified criteria, who's qualified, you know, who seems like they could run a really solid race, you know, it comes up Baldwin.
I've seen some arguments about how many votes having a vice presidential candidate from a particular state is going to bring to your party. Some people say not many. On the other hand, we have some really close elections here in Wisconsin where not many could be a deciding factor. Do you think just surely having a candidate from Wisconsin might be enough to nudge the balance one way or the other?
Yeah, so I have, you know, read through the research on this. I've done some of my own calculations, and you're right to say that the advantage usually isn't much. Vice presidents usually don't carry a home region. They oftentimes don't bring in that many votes. But there is some evidence that a vice presidential candidate that's sort of well-picked and placed correctly can get about 2 extra points in a given state. And given how important Wisconsin is, given how close this election could potentially be, depending on how it evolves, it sort of makes sense to think of those 2 points as very big and very helpful and as something that, you know, might be worth sort of guiding the Biden vice presidential pick, because that could make the difference.
Talking to David Beiler, data analyst and political columnist at The Washington Post. He wrote a series of articles looking at the pros, making the case for different potential running mates for Joe Biden. We're talking about the one today that he wrote about, Senator Tammy Baldwin, as the serious choice. David, from the perspective of Democrats, they might be thinking, and you talk about this in your piece, do we want to give up a senator in a state where elections can really be toss-ups and risk losing, Democrats would say, that Senate seat?
Right. So this is sort of, I think, the strongest piece of pushback against kind of the case for Baldwin. And I feel like all of these potential vice presidential candidates that I've written about have big strengths and then their Achilles heel. And this would be the Achilles heel of Baldwin, which is that, you know, Wisconsin is a very evenly divided state. And we know from recent elections sort of throughout history that when one party takes control of the presidency, the other party's stock starts to rise pretty fast. We saw it when Barack Obama was president. He won in 2008 and 2012. And then what happened in 2010 and 2014, the Republicans won. Same thing with Trump. He wins in 2016. Democrats win big in 2018. So there is a reasonable worry that if Baldwin were to vacate her Senate seat, that Republicans would not, maybe not just have the chance, but maybe even be favored to take that. And then that would imperil the Democratic ability to govern. The counter argument to that would be that the presidency is more important than the Senate majority, and you sort of have to do whatever's necessary. But, you know, the person who has to decide which argument is stronger is ultimately Joe Biden.
Another point you bring up is that Senator Baldwin has done well on the Wisconsin statewide political scene, but hasn't been a very prominent figure on the national scene like some of the senators, say, who have run for president in the past.
Right. So the way that I think about this is it's a little bit more of a lack of an advantage than a disadvantage. And I know that sounds like hair splitting, but I do think it helps if you've run for president to know what the, you know, sort of national spotlight is like, to have proven that you're somebody who a lot of Democratic voters like or have gotten behind at one point or another. But ultimately, in the end, the presidential nominee themselves is the one that's sort of in charge of bringing flash to the campaign, right? The fact that Baldwin didn't go through the entire primary, I think, is okay because Joe Biden did, and Democrats decided that, you know, they want him at the top of the ticket. So, yeah, I think in rare cases you have presidential candidates trying to sort of inject some flash or shake up the game with their vice presidential nominee. But when it comes to being on the campaign trail, sometimes do no harm is just a good rule.
Sometimes we look at running mates as, you know, reaching out to a particular constituency or balancing. So Mike Pence was viewed as reaching out to Republican white evangelical voters in particular, that wing of the party. Is there anything like that going on with the potential choice of Senator Baldwin?
I think that I would say progressives, but they don't know it yet. Baldwin has not been sort of the most visible progressive in the left wing of the Democratic Party. Obviously, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have a lot higher visibility than she does. But if you look at her actual voting record and you look at sort of the things that she stands for, she would be someone who comes from that sort of area to Biden's left. So I would say that that would be one area. And, you know, she's if I remember right, she's openly lesbian, and I think that would be interesting considering how much LGBT rights have become a really, really big part of the Democratic Party's platform and sort of their stance on social issues. So I think there's multiple things that she could bring in terms of constituencies that she would light up. And then there's the obvious fact that she's a woman in a party that's majority female. So I think that counts as well.
You wrote, again, a number of pieces about different candidates making the case, the positive case for them, for Democrats. Did you persuade yourself that one of them really is the best choice or the most likely choice?
I mean, I'll tell you, I don't know if I persuaded myself that one of them is the most likely, but I will say that writing the case for Baldwin made me sort of see the merits in that pick more than I had before. The same is true of Duckworth. And actually, writing the piece on Warren made me sort of less high on her and made me think like, oh, this case is actually harder to make when I have to, you know, write it down and it's not just in my head or in a tweet. So that's kind of how I've moved around. And also Klobuchar, I thought, was about as strong of a case as I expected, which was pretty strong.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to David Byler, data analyst and political columnist for The Washington Post. We talked to him today about the case for Joe Biden picking Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin to be his running mate in this year's presidential campaign. You can look forward to more national political coverage coming up this Wednesday on our weekly Week in Washington segment. We'll get the latest in the presidential race, the Senate, U.S. Senate swinging back into action, and other top stories in national politics. Last week on Central Time, we talked about bird watching here in Wisconsin this time of year. Tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation about hobbies. Let's bridge that gap now. Producer Jay Carlisle Larson is on the line. Hey, JC.
Hey, Rob.
So do I have this right? You are taking up, you're trying to bring yourself into the hobby of bird watching.
Yeah, I am. I literally, and I'm a little embarrassed to say this, outside of just my like walking around my neighborhood and pointing and yelling at birds, have decided to make it a little bit more of an official hobby and bought, you know, some binoculars, have been taking trips to various, you know, wildlife conservation areas in the state to, you know, look at birds, our fine feathered friends.
Now, I am very bad at distinguishing birds one from the other, except for like the really obvious ones, the big ones, the flashy ones, the ones that, you know, like red-winged blackbird, where the name is the description. Are you good at like distinguishing one bird from another?
Getting better, but up until very recently, no, I would say. And I do like red-winged blackbirds a lot, oddly enough. I like their calls, and I like the fact that they are very territorial and
they
will dive-bomb you. I've been dive-bombed by these birds on jogs before, so that's always really fun. But yeah, getting better at it, like was able to distinguish some birds over the weekend, like the American yellow warbler, which was very pretty. Got to see what looked like a very young, red-tailed hawk.
Nice. Well, we'll keep watch for more. I saw some turkeys myself this weekend. This is Central Time.